Well, it's really my honor to be here tonight. I know what a difference Mecca has made, what a difference Penny Rosenwasser and Barbara and Ziad and everybody at Mecca have made. And I think it's just great to bring my author, the man I am proud to call one of my authors, Miko Peled, to come and talk here tonight. Penny was talking a little bit about how things have changed since 1988. I came to this country in 1982, which, as I'm sure you all recall, was a really terrible year for the Palestinians, especially in Lebanon. And we have just gone through, over the past 3 days, 3 days of mourning and commemoration for the 3,000 or so Palestinian civilians, men, women, and children, who were killed in the refugee camps at Sabra and Shatila. In southern Beirut. Things have changed a lot in this country since then. Back then, I remember because I had newly come to this country, the vast majority of people in the progressive movement in this country were 100% in support of Israel. Jane Fonda was actually disporting herself atop a tank of the Israeli army as they shelled Beirut. That is how much the progressive movement in this country understood about what was happening to the Palestinian people. Things have changed so much, in large part because of the efforts of grassroots people around the country, here in the Bay Area, everybody working, spreading consciousness, spreading the truth about what's been happening. And so it's wonderful to see, you know, new generations of people coming up. I have to say, including my son and my daughter-in-law and my grandbaby who's running up and down there, but all of you have family members whom I'm sure you're really proud of and supportive of. So I founded my publishing company, Just World Books, and you can get our little flyer outside. The website is www.justworldbooks.com. With the aim of expanding the discourse in this country on all matters of international affairs, but with a special emphasis on the Middle East. And so I've published so far over the past 2 years 12 books, and about 8 of them have been about the Middle East. The others have been about the Afghanistan-Pakistan war theater. Soon after I started the company, I got insistent phone calls from two people. One was my very old friend, Landrum Bowling. Now, when I say a very old friend, Landrum is 98 and a half years old. Earlier this year, he was in Egypt. Last year, he got to Gaza. He is a diehard activist for peace and justice in the Middle East. And Landrum kept calling me and kept calling me, and he said, "You've got to publish this book by Miko Peled." Well, of course, I'd heard of General Matti Peled, historic leader of the peace movement in Palestine, but I hadn't at that point heard of Miko Peled. But I got on YouTube and I found the wonderful videos that he had been making. And then, you know, Landrum called me, let's say, 4 or 5 times. I have to say, Miko called me about 40 or 50 times to get this whole plan organized and to get the book brought out in the form that it is currently in, and it came out earlier this year. And it has been such a pleasure to work with Miko and to really discover his story and the passion and commitment with which he tells his story, both in print and verbally. And it's really my pleasure to introduce him here tonight. He probably doesn't need so much introduction from me because he is a sort of a California person. He lives in San Diego when he's not in Jerusalem. Obviously, he grew up in this family that was in the bosom of the Zionist elite, but which always had family members, primarily his mother and his father, who were prepared to challenge some of the basic tenets of the Zionist movement. So Miko, and in particular his older sister Nurit, have both really taken this legacy from the family and pushed it a lot further. I'm going to have the honor to meet Nurit in New York next month. But I've been aware of her work for a long time. Miko's work speaks to the heart. He and I have both had this amazing experience of so many Palestinians writing and saying they had never heard this from Israelis before, from Jewish Israelis before. So I don't want to carry on any longer because I think Miko can tell his story much better than I can. Just know that he is an amazing visionary. He is your neighbor in Southern California. He has a wonderful wife called Gila. He has three beautiful children, and the oldest is just going off to UCLA, which is where his father, interestingly, Matty Peled, did his Arabic language and literature studies back in the 1960s. So there seems to be a kind of a California karma about this family, and it really is my huge pleasure to introduce to you all Miko Peled.
Thank you so much, Helena, for that very warm introduction, and thank you all for being here today. It's interesting, we're talking about, Helena mentioned the California connection, and my father, I was just handed a flyer here from, that talks about, speaks about, or advertises as a talk by my father here at Berkeley on February the 10th, 1983. And I understand quite a few of you were there, so thank you for bringing this to my attention, and thank you for your continued efforts and your continued work in regards to the issue of Palestine. I also want to point out and express my gratitude to Alice Walker, who's here, who's lended her very important voice to the Palestinian issue. Both in her blog and being in the flotilla and with the Russell Tribunal, and was extremely generous in writing the foreword to my book. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. I'd like to begin my talks with a disclaimer. So if Helen has heard this many, many times. And the disclaimer is this. If anybody here came expecting to hear a balanced presentation, they're going to be sorely disappointed. And the reason for that is, number one, I don't believe a balanced presentation on this issue is possible. If anybody says that their presentation is balanced, they're either misleading themselves or their audiences. And I think that, I mean, everybody knows, everybody's got a strong opinion on this issue, everybody has strong feelings, strong emotions on this issue. For me, it's a deeply personal issue, so there's no way it could be balanced. The other reason that it can't be balanced is that it's not a balanced situation. We don't have a balanced story here. A lot of times we hear people compare it to, two kids that maybe just can't get along on the playground. They need to be allowed to sort it out. I think a better analogy would be a lunatic child with a loaded gun running around in the schoolyard shooting everyone. And so somebody's got to intervene and somebody's got to do something about it. So like I said, balanced this is not, but I hope you will bear with me if you find some of the things that I say difficult to accept and difficult to hear. I think in order to do this justice, to do the Israeli-Palestinian conflict justice, we have to look at the past, we have to dispel some of the myths, and we have to take into consideration that there's a huge double standard when talking about this issue here in America, and in the West in general. There's this myth that says that this is a conflict that's been going on for generations, for hundreds or thousands of years, and that there's really no end in sight because it's been going on forever. Well, this is not true. This is a political conflict, and I think if we were to put a to pinpoint a time where we can really start talking about the conflict as it is today, that would be November 29th, 1947, when the United Nations decided to partition Palestine. The map on the screen is the partition plan. It's also important to remember that at that time, there were two communities living kind of on parallel existence. There was a Jewish community that numbered about 500,000 people, and there was a Palestinian community that numbered about 1.5 million people. Yet somehow, when the United Nations decided on the partition, they decided to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller community, and the smaller portion to the larger community. Who in their right mind thought this would work, I don't know. But I'd venture to say that nobody expected it to work. And then the story that we hear, the myth that we hear about this, is that immediately after the Jewish community finally got that kind of recognition, where the United Nations recognized that a part of historical Israel should be dedicated to a Jewish state, the Arabs attacked with the intent of destroying that small Jewish community. And somehow, miraculously, because they were smart and because they were dedicated and because they held the moral high ground, they prevailed and they won, and of course the Arabs, you know, all disappeared. But when we look at the period between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948, and what actually took place, the story doesn't work. The myth just doesn't work. Like I said, the two communities were living separate but kind of parallel realities, parallel lives. Both of them were states in the making. The Palestinians were hoping to have an Arab state be established and recognized, and the Jews were hoping, the Zionists were hoping to have a Jewish state recognized. And they had institutions of state and so on. The one thing, though, that the Zionist community, the Jewish community, had, which the Palestinians did not have, was a fighting force, a militia. From very early on, the Zionist leadership invested a lot in indoctrinating and training and arming a militia. And my father, as a young man, volunteered to be, was part of that militia. He was part of the Haganah. Palestinians did not have anything like that. Now, within that year, 1 year period between the end of 47 and the end of 48, something very interesting happened. The Zionist forces managed to conquer almost 80% of the country. They managed to destroy more than 500 towns and villages, including schools and churches and mosques and homes. And they managed to forcibly exile almost 1 million people. And they did all that while they were being attacked from the outside? This doesn't work. Especially since we realize the Palestinians never had a fighting force. Never had an army, never had a militia. So it just doesn't work. And it's important to take a look at this picture, this absurd map that was put together by the United Nations to begin to see how absurd, or what absurd notions they had about the reality in Israel and Palestine. Now, what I did in the book, what I was able to do in the book very successfully and with a lot of help, of course, was to weave in the personal story of my story's family within the context of the state of Israel, and also the story of the two nations. And I mentioned in the book a story that my mother told me, and I can't recall when she told me the story, but I know she told it to me many, many times as I was growing up. Now, my mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She's still alive. She's 86. She lives there still. And she used to talk about when she was a child, she would walk around the Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem. Now, we're talking about the new West Jerusalem. And she would see the families, the Palestinian families, sitting under the lemon tree and, you know, on the weekends and so on and so forth. In 1948, she was 22 years old. She had two children. And her husband, my father, was fighting for the Zionist cause. And as the Palestinian communities, these Palestinian neighborhoods in West Jerusalem were evacuated, or the word they use in Hebrew is cleansed or sterilized, which means the Arabs were kicked out. These homes became available. And if anybody's been to Jerusalem, you know these are very distinct homes. They're beautiful, large homes with beautiful gardens. And they're all, by and large, they're all still there. And she was offered one of these homes. As they were made available, they were given to Israeli Jewish families. And she couldn't bring herself to take the home of another mother. And she said, how could I possibly take the home of another mother? How can I move into the home of a family that has been forced into exile and now lives in a refugee camp? And then she would talk about the truckloads that the Israelis, you know, driven by Israelis, full of loot, because these are well-to-do families. These are beautiful homes. They had rugs and they had furniture, and they were all looted. And she felt a sense of shame for these people. She couldn't understand how they were not ashamed to do this. And she also talks about, and I've heard this from other people as well, that when the soldiers came in, when the Zionist forces came in, the coffee was still warm on the table. In other words, the families had just fled. Now, the problem with the story is that it didn't fit the story that I was told. The national narrative, the narrative that I was taught as a boy going to a school in Israel, doesn't fit this. Because the story is that the Arabs left. They attacked us, we won, they left, and we get the spoils. But if that's true, what was wrong with taking a home? Why did she not agree to take the home? Where's the problem? And I remember this troubling me, kind of sitting in the back of my mind for many, many years, and it wasn't until I was actually working on the book that I was able to reconcile this and realize that what she was telling me was that the national narrative is not true. The narrative, the story that we're told, and people are being told this story here too, by candidates for presidency, that the Jewish community was attacked in 47, luckily they won, and so on and so forth, and the Arabs left. Now, this is the general, this is my father, and the story has two parts. It has the general's son, which is a big part of who I am and who I was, and then the other part is the journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The two are connected, but they're two distinct parts. Now, my father, after the war was won, after Israel was created, what we call the War of Independence, Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, he remained in the military as an officer and had a very distinctive military career. He was the governor of Gaza when it was occupied in 1956, and that was his first interaction with Palestinians. He suddenly realized, once Gaza was occupied after the war in 1956, that he was placed in the position to be the overlord, the occupier of these people, and he had no way to communicate with them. He knew nothing about them. He didn't speak their language. And he, of course, he didn't like that at all. And so he started studying Arabic, and of course, Arabic language and literature became his second career later on. But his impression was always that the people in Gaza, in other words, I'll backtrack. His impression of the people in Gaza was once again completely different than what was told to us as a nation. As Israel was preparing for war, and I talk about this in the book a little bit, about the reasons for this and how the Israeli top brass and the leadership, the Zionist leadership, wanted to begin this war against Egypt. The story was, these refugees in Gaza, from whom we took the land, are waiting for an opportunity to slaughter us and take their homes back because they don't like the fact that we took their land. Now, this was being said by people like Moshe Dayan. This was the narrative. So we have to go in there and make sure that they don't do that. Now, if anybody knows anything about the refugees in Gaza, it's absolutely clear they had no ability to attack anybody. Well, when my father ended his role as being the governor of Gaza, he wrote a very well-known report. It was called the Gaza Report, and he describes the people in Gaza as nothing but willing to and desiring to live in harmony and peace with Israel, just to move on beyond this conflict and get back to normal life. And so again, I was hearing this one story about somebody who was actually there and his impression from the people, and this other story, which was a national narrative. Now, in 1967, as we all know, there's another Middle East war, about 10 years after that. By then, my father was a general. And in the spring of 1967, the drums of war were beating. As some of you may recall, the Egyptian president, Nasser, decided to kick out the peacekeepers from the Sinai Peninsula, which was demilitarized and kept the two countries apart, and allow his forces to go into the Sinai Peninsula. And he also threatened to close the Straits of Tiran, which would not allow Israeli ships to go up to the port city of Eilat. So the Israeli army, the Israeli generals said this was a reason for war, and they wanted to begin a war. Now, a lot has been written and a lot has been said, and many movies have been made about this period between the spring of 1967 and the summer in June when the war actually began. And it's a fascinating story, because the generals wanted war, which is not surprising. They saw an opportunity for war and they wanted the war. The Israeli cabinet, however, was very hesitant. And when we look at these two groups, it's very, very interesting. They're two completely, entirely different groups of people. We had a cabinet. The cabinet members were older. They were in their mid to late 60s. Most of them were born in exile. They had suffered the pogroms. The Holocaust was only 25 years behind them. And they were fearful and they were cautious and they were not at all excited about the possibility of war. The generals were in their early to mid 40s. Almost all of them were born in Palestine. Almost all of them were part of the Zionist militia before the state was created. And they were this new Jew that the Zionists wanted to create, this wonderful creation full of testosterone that was ready to fight, and they were very assertive. And the relationship between these two groups was very interesting, and there was a real tug of war, very serious, very strong tug of war between them, until finally the government succumbed and gave the okay for the army to begin a preemptive strike against Egypt. Now, as I was working on the book, I chose to go and take a look at the Israeli Army archives to learn more about my father's career. And one of the things I wanted to see was the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the 1967 war. And again, a great deal has been written about it, and I thought I read everything, and wasn't expecting any surprises. Yet as I was reading the minutes of these meetings, particularly the meetings between the top brass of the army and the cabinet, my father said something, and then some of the other generals repeated it. And what they said was that the Egyptian army was not prepared for war, and therefore we have an opportunity to destroy them quite easily. In other words, they needed at least a year and a half to 2 years before they would be ready for war. So we have an opportunity to attack and destroy them. Now, what is the story? What is the story that we hear about the 1967 war? Israel was once again attacked by Arab armies intent on destroying it. And once again, miraculously, because they were motivated and because they were smart, and now we hear that they were culturally somehow, advanced or something. And by the grace of God, they not only defeated their enemies, but they conquered all this land and so on. Once again, this myth doesn't fit in with the story of what actually took place. They're talking, not talking about an existential threat, they're talking about an opportunity. They're saying that the fact that the Egyptians brought their army closer to Israel was an advantage to Israel and made it easier to destroy the Egyptian army. Nothing, by the way, about the Jordanians or about the Syrians. So the cabinet gave the okay, and the Israeli army went and defeated, destroyed the Egyptian army, conquered the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip once again in a matter of days. Now, one issue that was left unfinished, considered unfinished business by the generals in particular, was the issue of the West Bank. When the war of 1948 ended, the West Bank was not in the hands of Israel. And the Israeli commanders, the army commanders, were very upset about that, because they believed Israel had the military capability of taking that piece of land way back in 48, but for political reason, Israel decided not to pursue that. They had pushed for years and years and years for war that would allow Israel to take the West Bank so that Israel's eastern boundary would be the Jordan River. Well, here was an opportunity. There were already in the motions of war. The war was already taking place. It would be nothing for them to take the West Bank. So the generals, along with Moshe Dayan, who was Minister of Defense, without cabinet approval, took the West Bank and then took the Golan Heights, which was a piece of land that Israel had wanted for many, many years because it has water resources and so on. So once again, let's take a look at what happened. It all ended in 6 days. What happened in those 6 days? Israel destroyed 3 Arab armies, conquered the West Bank, conquered the Golan Heights, conquered the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip, killed over 15,000 Arab soldiers at a loss of 700 soldiers. And we're told that they were attacked by massive armies intending to destroy it, and they did all this. So once again, as we look at the myth and we look at the reality, we see that it just doesn't work. And then as we look again, we see that there's a common thread here. And the common thread is painting Israel as this small David fighting this massive Goliath, and just through sheer luck or the grace of God or whoever it might be, being able to prevail and conquer and prevail and conquer. Now, my father did something very interesting. At the end of the war, at the very first meeting of the general staff after the war, he got up and he said, "We now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem. Let's allow the Palestinians to establish a state in the West Bank and Gaza." Makes sense in terms of the partition plan, because the partition plan initially wanted to provide for both nations who share that land. Now Israel was in a much better position. And he said, if we want to maintain a Jewish democracy, we can't be occupying millions of Arabs. We're either not going to be Jewish or we're not going to be a democracy. This is not what we fought for. But in reality, what took place is, immediately as the war was over, within days, a massive settlement project began in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. Now, I have a picture here that I like to show. It demonstrates, these are all the generals. This is the victory picture, with the president of the State of Israel, Zalman Shazar, who was, representing that other generation. He wasn't really a cabinet member. The president is kind of a symbolic position. But here he is, with all these wonderful young new Zionist Jews that had delivered the land of Israel to the Jewish people, finally after 2,000 years. And this only after 25 years after the Holocaust. From a Jewish perspective, from a Zionist historical perspective, this is unprecedented. We're finally back. And this generation of these generals was termed by one Hebrew poet as the silver tray upon which the land of Israel was presented back to the Jewish people. In reality, this is what took place. Over a 20 to 25 year period, Palestine was erased and Israel took its place. The ethnic cleansing that took place in 1947 began at the end of 1947, 1948. It goes on to this day. It's not only a matter of taking the land. It's not only a matter of expelling the population. It's also a matter of de-Arabizing the country. This country that has 1,500 years of Arab history, Arab and Muslim history. So it means destroying monuments. It means either destroying or allowing them to stay in disrepair until they crumble to the ground. It means changing the names of places. It means rewriting a history and completely ignoring this other reality. The problem, of course, is that the Arabs won't go and the culture won't go. And so what do we do? Israel has, and this again goes back to when people talk about the West Bank as a possible Palestinian state today. And maybe, perhaps, there could be some kind of resolution where Israel and the Palestinians agree on this kind of a two-state solution. The reason this is a misunderstanding is this. If we take a look at what Israel did in 1948 and then immediately after the war, and we take a look at what Israel did in 1967 and immediately after that war, it's clear that it's the exact same thing. One is the continuation of the other. In other words, ethnically cleansing, you know, getting rid of the people, taking their land, and investing heavily in building cities and towns and highways and so on for Israeli Jews only. This took place after 1948 in all of Palestine, and then it went on and did the exact same thing. Israel did the exact same thing in the West Bank after that. This is a continuation of another. There's no pause here. After the 1967 war, Israel did everything it could so that that conquest would be irreversible. And they succeeded. And the name of the game is de-Arabizing the country. If you've been to Jerusalem, if you've been to the old city of Jerusalem, you may have seen right outside the Jewish quarter is a community called Silwan. Silwan sits in the valley, right outside of where the Wailing Wall is and so on. It's a community of 50,000 people. Now somebody decided that under Silwan sits the original city of King David. Never mind the fact that there is no historical proof that a King David ever existed. But there's a massive process of ethnic cleansing, destruction of homes, taking place in Silwan right now, and a massive park called the City of David that's being built by Israel. 50,000 people have to be kicked out of their homes and their community destroyed to do what? To somehow create a mythical connection between today's Israel and biblical Israel of the days of King David, the glory of King David. Completely mythical. And when you stand there and if you look, you see the Jewish quarter on the hill, and then you see Silwan on the bottom, and you can see how somebody envisioned this grand Jewish mythological park, completely erasing the Arab nature of the land, of Jerusalem. And this is going on, Silwan is one example, it goes on in countless places. But this is a process that it's important to understand. Erasing Palestine, de-Arabizing the land, is a big part of the Zionist mission. I would say it defines the Zionist mission. And therefore there has not been any compromise, and never will be a compromise, on the issue of the land. When my father retired from the military a year after the 1967 war, he began a career teaching Arabic literature, but also continued to speak and write about the need to allow the Palestinians a state in the West Bank and Gaza, and he worked as an advocate for Palestinians who were citizens of Israel, the rights of Palestinians within the state of Israel, and he fought for equal rights for them. In the mid-1970s, representatives of the PLO sent by Yasser Arafat himself reached out to my father and several other Israelis, prominent Israelis, in an effort to begin a dialogue, because they too saw that this could be a good solution. But what's interesting is that it wasn't until 1993 that an official Israeli government was willing to actually engage with the PLO. And it's interesting, on the back of this flyer from 1983, there's a little clip, and again, thank you for putting this, giving this to me today. This is from January 1983, and it talks about the meeting, a very well-documented, well-reported meeting between my father and Yasser Arafat, and several other prominent Israelis, Uri Avneri and Yaakov Arnon. And these were people that were really on the Israeli side, the people that used to hold important positions, but they're really renegades. On the Palestinian side, the dialogue was always conducted by official delegates of the PLO. So it really wasn't a balanced kind of a situation, talking about balance again. But what's interesting here is this. Okay, the report says this. The meeting was denounced by both Prime Minister Menachem Begin of the Likud bloc and the opposition Labor Party, which was headed at the time by Shimon Peres. Begin and most Israeli politicians refused to deal with the PLO. Now the negotiations with the PLO, the talks, the dialogue began in the mid-70s. This is, by the way, my father was Issam Sartawi, who was
the Palestinian ambassador to Paris for many, many years. He was later killed. He was killed in 1983, shortly after this meeting took place, the meeting with Arafat took place. But it took 20 years for an Israeli government to actually agree to talk with the PLO and begin negotiations. What happened in those 20, well, what happened in those all those years? What was it that suddenly made Israel agree to meet and talk to the PLO and discuss the possibility of a Palestinian state? I would argue that what happened was the Israeli government knew for certain that there was no chance in the world a Palestinian state could be established in the West Bank because there was no more West Bank. They had succeeded in making the conquest of all of Palestine irreversible. And what they were hoping to do is give Arafat and some of his people little areas to control to make it easier for Israel to go on about its life. People forget that at the best, the most liberal-leaning Israeli government, headed by Rabin and Peres and so on, the best they were willing to do was to give the Palestinians small parts of the West Bank that were determined by Israel, not including East Jerusalem, and not including the Jordan River Valley, which is about a third of the West Bank. In other words, these parts were not even up for negotiations. So when Bill Clinton brought the Israelis and the Palestinians to Camp David in 2000, the attempt was not to come out with an agreement for peace. The attempt was to bring about a complete surrender of the Palestinians. And then Bill Clinton came out and said, well, Arafat gave some, but Barak gave more. In other words, Arafat was not willing to make concessions. And this is the myth that prevails to this day. Let's take a look at what actually happened. By accepting the idea of a two-state solution based on a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, which is an idea that was pushed forward by Yasser Arafat, he and his, as the Palestinian representative, agreed to give up 80% of Palestine, to give up 80% of historical Palestine for the sake of peace, to give up the dream of Palestinian refugees, millions of Palestinian refugees, to ever return to their homes or be compensated. This is a massive concession. Yet Arafat died with Israeli tanks surrounding him because he was not willing to make concessions. This was the myth. It's because he was not willing to surrender. And he was vilified, and to this day when you hear Arafat in this country, of course, Arafat was this, you know, this some kind of Osama bin Laden. And I would argue that Arafat was the most consistent voice for peace in the Middle East between the mid-1970s until the day he died in 2004. Because he did not waver. He said peace could be established only if the Palestinians could establish their own state in the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem, which again is only 20-22% of their historical homeland. But in terms of the Zionist principles, this is not acceptable because it's a zero-sum game. For the state of Israel, for the Zionist state, there cannot be any compromise on the issue of the land. And that's why they cannot be a partner to any peace agreement. The two chapters in the book are dedicated to the death of my niece, Smadar. She was killed on September 4th, 1997, when two young Palestinians blew themselves up in downtown Jerusalem, took their own lives, took her life, and several other Israelis. Now, I was living here already at the time, and it's the kind of tragedy that you really don't know how to express in words. I mean, these are emotions that are absolutely beyond us. I flew, of course, I took the first plane back to Jerusalem. I arrived in the morning, and on the morning, the front page of the morning paper, it already said the granddaughter of General Peled killed by Palestinian suicide bombers. Now, this was big news because he was a famous general, but it was also big news because he was Mr. Peace with Palestine. And the message behind this was, didn't do him any good, did it? See what these Palestinians did to him. Well, my sister set everybody straight, and she set me straight, and she helped me wrap my head around this, and, you know, a lot of us. Because when she finally came out to face the, you know, the hordes of people who came to express their sympathy and mourn, and also the hordes of reporters, she was asked about retaliation and about revenge. And the first thing she said is, look, no real mother would ever want this to happen to any other mother. And if she's anything above all, it's she is a mother. She's got three other boys, wonderful boys. Motherhood being this uniting force that cuts through all the nonsense of, you know, religion and ethnic differences and so on. And the second thing she said is, she said, I point a finger at the people who brought these two young Palestinians to a level of such despair and such hopelessness that they would take away their own lives and take away the lives of other innocent people. This is a level of despair. This is a level of hopelessness. This is a result of the brutal occupation and the brutal oppression under which we, the Israelis, keep the Palestinians. And therefore, she said, I point a finger at my government for bringing these people to be able to do this sort of thing. So, of course, like I said, she set them straight, she set me straight, because it kind of put us on a path. And then she became a celebrity. The LA Times, the New York Times, everybody, the Guardian suddenly became, started interviewing her and so forth. This bereaved Israeli mother is criticizing the Prime Minister, Israel's Prime Minister. Now, the Prime Minister at the time was Bibi Netanyahu, the same as today. And Bibi was a close personal friend of the family. Was. And there's an interesting side story that I mentioned in the book about how this all, you know, how this all developed. But basically, you need that kind of a strong inspiration in order to continue to live. And so Nurit has been involved and has been very, very active. She just published an amazing book about racism in Israeli textbooks, in Israeli school books. And she's an activist, and she's part of the Russell Tribunal, same as Alice Walker here. They'll be in New York next month. And I came back to San Diego, and well, what do I do now? I go back to work? I mean, what do you do? I mean, you just can't do this. And I started looking for things that I could do, and I was very fortunate in that I found a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group in San Diego. And I began going to meetings, and this was the first time I ever sat with Palestinians. First of all, the first time I sat with Palestinians, period. Now, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. It's a mixed city. It's a united city, as we all know. But it's a completely segregated city, too. Completely racist city. So as an Israeli, I never met Palestinians. I mean, I saw them doing yard work and, you know, working in kitchens. But I never met Palestinians. So this is the first time I actually sat with, not only met, so beyond the fact that I only met them, I met them and we were completely equal. They didn't need a permit to be there. They didn't need to be back home because of curfew. There was no army checkpoints that they had to go through. I mean, we were completely equal in every way. And they very gently took me through this very painful process of realizing that my side was not right. And I came thinking, you know, I know everything. With my family background, I know everything. I thought this would be an interesting exercise to meet and talk. And if you're going to go through that kind of a painful experience, that painful transformation, it's like discovering that one of your parents is an alcoholic or a drug dealer or something, or a serial killer. I mean, it's an unbelievably painful process. Then it's nice to have Palestinians around because they're very supportive group of people. And those particular people were good friends of mine, and they helped me along to realize that not only was my side not the only side, but it really, the truths that I knew were to a very large degree myths. And it took several years. I talk about it now, but it was a very difficult and very long process. Well, after I had gotten to meet Palestinians, I thought, well, let's go back to the old country and meet Palestinians there. So I began traveling and meeting Palestinians within Israel, and I began meeting Palestinians and traveling into the West Bank and meeting Palestinians there. And as I was traveling to the West Bank, this is what I saw. Now it's in Hebrew. But it's red with white lettering, which means danger. And if you've been to any of the checkpoints, if you've gone to checkpoints, Calandia or any of the others, this sign is about the size of, well, it's about the size of the sign up on the screen. And what it says is this. It says, this road, if you continue on this road, it leads to Area A, which is under Palestinian control. Entry to Israelis into Area A is forbidden. It is life-threatening, and it constitutes a felony. Two exclamation marks. In other words, if the red and white didn't scare you, and the fact that it's a felony and it's you're risking your life didn't scare you by this point, the two exclamation marks will scare you for sure. And it's only relevant if you can read Hebrew. It's only relevant if you can read Hebrew. Now, anybody with a little bit of sense would see the sign and go back home. Who would continue? Who would go? It's like saying, it's like reading that there's a firing range and you would just keep going. Who would keep going? To my good fortune, I don't have that kind of sense. And I went through, and many of my friends did the same thing. You know, traffic jams, kids going to school, people going to work, shops, and that's it. And that's it. Nobody troubles me. Nobody cares that I'm an Israeli. Nobody cares that I'm there other than the friends that I come to visit. There are no, you know, Palestinian terrorists with guns or with explosives waiting to kill me. There's nothing. And very gradually it began to dawn on me that this has nothing to do with security. That the wall has nothing to do with security. That the massive amount of Israeli forces that stand between Israelis and Palestinians have nothing to do with security. That the horrific humiliation that Palestinians have to go through every time they go through Israeli airport, Tel Aviv airport, has nothing to do with security. This is all part of a racist system that is designed to humiliate and destroy an entire people. And it's meant to keep us apart. Through fear, through intimidation, through things like this, through walls and so on. That is what this is for. Now I want to read something very interesting to you that I found actually, funny enough, only recently. This is a United Nations resolution from 1973. And it reads that the struggles of people under colonial and alien domination and racist regimes for the implementation of their right to self-determination and independence is legitimate and in full accordance with the principles of international law. I would say the colonial, alien domination and racist regime categorizes Israel, 100%. And any struggle against that is therefore legitimate and in full accordance with the principles of international law. Now, in this picture, I'm standing with a good friend of mine, Jamal Mansour, who was a prisoner for many, many years. He sat in prison for many years, in Israeli prison. And he was given life sentence, in fact. And he was exchanged in one of the big prisoner exchanges that Israel conducted with the PLO. Now, what he did was, he and three others snuck up behind two Israeli soldiers that were guarding an Israeli bank in Ramallah. Why were they guarding an Israeli bank in Ramallah? Who knows? But there they were, fully armed, of course, and these four young Palestinians, this was a long time ago, snuck up behind them and stabbed them to death. Israel calls this that he has blood on his hands. So even though he was released from prison early, he still can't travel, and there are a lot of restrictions on his life. And he was arrested many, many times and harassed, but that's besides the point. The thing is this, which one, now I, on the other hand, joined and volunteered to serve in an Israeli commando unit when it was my time to serve in the Israeli army. The service was mandatory, but I didn't have to volunteer to a combat unit. I served a military force that was upholding an occupation, an illegal occupation, oppressing an entire nation. Which one of us is the terrorist? This is the question I think has to be raised. Which one of the two of us is the terrorist? According to this United Nations resolution, it's very clear. not him. Because I was there representing that colonial alien dominating regime that was also racist on top of everything. And I think this is a very, very important distinction to be made. The book ends, the very final chapter of the book talks about, well, how do we move from here? I call it one state, two states, three states. And in the last chapter, my brother-in-law Rami, Smadar's father, who's also very, very active and outspoken against the occupation and so on, talk about the solution. He still calls himself a Zionist, and he still believes that the Jews deserve their state and the Palestinians deserve their state. And therefore, the two-state solution is the solution for which we need to struggle. I don't view it that way. But I think it's important to take a look and see how Israel operates. When people talk about the two-state solution, they assume that there could be an Israel that allows the Palestinians to establish their own state. I would argue that could never happen. When you listen to Bibi Netanyahu or other Israeli prime ministers, they will say, and they've said it many, many times, there is no difference between Tel Aviv and Maale Adumim, which is a city in the West Bank. There is no difference between Halamish, which is a settlement in the West Bank, and Haifa or Jerusalem. In other words, they are one and the same. Which means what? Which means the West Bank is a part of Israel. The life of every single person who lived between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and there are about 11 million people there, are all governed by the same government, the Israeli government. The Palestinian Authority has less authority than a city council. Now, how does Israel do this? It does this, and this is why many people compare Israel to apartheid. Israel has different sets of laws for different populations. There are the laws that govern the lives of people like me, which are completely democratic. I can say what I want, I can come and go as I want, I'm a citizen, I'm privileged. End of story. I'm an Israeli Jew. Then there are the laws that govern the lives of Palestinians who are the citizens of Israel. And you often hear, well, you know, they have it so well, and the Palestinians in Israel have it so well, that number one, they can vote, and number two, they don't even want to leave. Some of them even have beautiful homes. The Palestinian communities within Israel are so neglected that some of them are in worse shape than Gaza. This is one of the biggest lies that is told about Israel, that it's somehow the Palestinian population within Israel have democratic rights. Beyond that, there are over 30 laws on the Israeli law books that discriminate against the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. And that's besides the entire culture and the entire environment of racism. A young Palestinian couple who are Israeli citizens cannot get a mortgage. It's not by law. It's just a reality. A young Palestinian couple can't go to a bank and ask for a mortgage. I was told this by a bank manager. They can't get a mortgage. A young Palestinian could have the best grades. Doesn't mean he's going to get a job. Doesn't mean he or she are going to get an apartment. They'll get to the interview and then they'll be told, yes, but you know, we'd love to hire you. You're a good guy, but you know what? The guy sitting next to you in the office is from a settlement and we don't want to create any friction, so call us back next year. And there's a sense that Arabs are the enemy. And then there are the laws that govern the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, which are determined by the Israeli military. It's a brutal regime where Palestinians can be killed, they can be arrested, they can be tortured, including children. There are thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners sitting in Israeli jails, in violation of international law, by the way. So the laws that govern their lives, they have no protection under any law. But everybody's governed by the State of Israel. Everybody's governed by the State of Israel. And by the way, speaking of the Palestinian prisoners, over 90%, or I should say it the other way, less than 10% have been charged or even have been accused of violent crimes. Over 90% are political prisoners have never engaged in violence at all. These are not hardened criminals, hardened terrorists. These are all political prisoners. And the reality of the Palestinian resistance is that the vast majority of Palestinian resistance has been nonviolent. As principle, by principle, Palestinians have never had a military force. But this image of Palestinians as terrorists was, you know, Israel was able to perpetuate that. But the reality is, now, can we expect, is it realistic to expect that people will live, an entire population will live under these conditions and not resort to any type of violence? Is that even realistic? That people will live in Gaza, being bombed and massacred from the air, and no violent resistance will appear at all? That's a stupid assumption. That's an insane assumption. What's amazing is how little it is, how little violence Palestinians have ever used. The vast majority of Palestinian resistance has always been nonviolent. But going back to the state thing, Israel-Palestine is one state. It's a racist apartheid state. There's no question about that. It is governed by a racist regime that has to go. There is no way that this racist regime, this state of Israel, will ever allow a Palestinian state to emerge, because it stands in the face of what Zionism is. It stands in the face of what the state of Israel is. The only way forward is to fight against this racist regime, just like people fought against apartheid in South Africa, and just like people fought against racist laws here in this country. And then to create a democracy. Now, when Jewish population, when you talk about this to, you know, when you say something like this to mainstream Jewish audiences, they say, ah, you see, genocide, Holocaust. You and Ahmadinejad, you want to destroy us. The notion that somehow transformation has to be violent is absurd. It doesn't have to be violent. A state can be transformed from a racist, dictatorial regime, an evil regime, to a democracy without violence. It's been done before. Multinational states exist and do just fine. But there's this myth again that says, you know, if we go against Zionism, if we go against the state of Israel, then we're all Nazis, which is, of course, absurd. So I would argue, and I'm going to end with this, that the best thing that people who care for peace, and I know many of you have been doing this far longer than I have, is to dedicate the efforts to eliminate Zionism and to work for a real democracy so that Israelis and Palestinians can actually fulfill this wonderful opportunity that they have in living this wonderful country and create something new together. Thank you very much.
Now it's going to be your turn to get to ask me.
Reason. The manipulation that the Israeli Water Authority does with the water is absolutely unbelievable. You know, all the water is governed by the Israeli Water Authority. And they determine how much water is allocated. And you'd be amazed when you hear the numbers. Okay, Israelis get 300 cubic meters of water per year per person. The World Health Organization recommends at least 100 cubic meters of water per person. Palestinians get somewhere between 30 and 80 cubic meters of water per person, depending on where they live exactly. And of course, a lot of the water sits in the West Bank. One of the biggest water reservoirs is in the West Bank. But the Israeli settlers in the West Bank receive 1,500 cubic meters of water per person per year. So you can have an Israeli settlement, an Israeli city, you know, with green lawns and swimming pools, and just down the road from there, a Palestinian town with no drinking water. Why would they do this? I mean, do Palestinians drink less or wash less, or do their plants need less water? So this issue of water is a very, very important one. So I have to commend Mecca again for working on that. On the issue of the refuse, you know, I think some of the bravest Israelis today are the people who refuse. There's no question about that. I remember when this began, there were always some refusers, but it kind of began as a movement in 1982 with the Lebanon War. And I remember my father being the first one to stand up and defend them. Because serving in the Israeli army is
is wrong and it's a crime. And it's better to, now, it's, what's interesting in Israel, Israel doesn't recognize conscientious objection. Because Israel is always right, so how could you possibly, if you have a conscience, how could you possibly object to serving Israel? So you can get out of the service by doing, you know, saying you're crazy, saying you don't adjust, saying you're getting married, saying you have asthma. It's very easy. About 50% of the people don't enlist. And it's very easy to get out. If you choose to say that you're a conscientious objector, you're going to jail. So the ones that are actually saying it know they're going to jail, and they know that there are easier ways to get out. And they choose to do this. And they're men, both men and women. And I think they're very, very brave. The consequences are that you're going to be an outcast for the rest of your life. Now, if you don't mind that and you live within a community of people who are progressive and like-minded, that's not a problem. But if you have, if you went to a normal school and you grew up as just a regular kid, this means this will define the rest of your life. And it's probably began defining your life when you were about 16 or 15, because that's the age where Israelis start talking about the military. What are you going to do? Where are you going to serve? You know, the whole, the conversation from that, like here in America, the conversation is college and things like that. In Israel, the conversation is the military. So if you are going to, if you know that you're going to object to serve, from that point on, you've been targeted. And then, you know, it's difficult in just conducting your daily life. You know, and of course they sit in jail, and they put them in jail with hardened prisoners on purpose. The judges call them criminals, and they put them in jail with hardened prisoners on purpose. But they sit for no more than a year. After about a year, they're kind of excused. And they're sent away. But I think I'll say one more thing about that. I think there's no doubt today that the Israeli army is probably one of the best funded, best armed, best fed terrorist organizations in the world. Because they are dedicated to terrorism. They are dedicated to terrorizing the lives of Palestinians. You know, we talked about Sabra and Shatila. We talked about Lebanon. Let's talk about Gaza of exactly 4 years ago, or almost exactly 4 years ago. On the 27th, and I always say the 27th of December 2008 will be remembered as the darkest day in the history of the Jewish people. Because at 11:25 in the morning, Israeli Air Force jets began carpet bombing Gaza. And on the first day of a 21-day assault, they dropped 100 tons of bombs on a civilian population with 800,000 children. Now, as many of you know, I'm sure Gaza is a very densely populated place. Now, a one-ton bomb will destroy a city block. A one-ton bomb will destroy a city block. Can you imagine 100 tons of bombs on a densely populated area on the first day of a 21-day assault with nobody on the ground that has any means of protection or fighting back? There is no army. There are no tanks in Gaza. There are no missiles in Gaza. There's no artillery. There are no air defenses. There's nothing. They don't have an F-16. They never had a helicopter. They don't have a tank. I mean, they don't have any of this sort of thing. They never have. Then once the Air Force was done, the ground troops began. And I don't know if you saw pictures, but if you see pictures, you see the ground forces waiting to enter Gaza. You see rows and rows of tanks. You'd think they're preparing to fight the Russian army in World War II. Who are they expecting to fight? There's no one to fight on the other side. There is no other army on the other side. This was a massacre, intended to be a massacre, without any question. People talk about it, well, they call it Operation Cast Lead, the war in Gaza. This was not an operation, it was not a war, it was a massacre. It was a cruel massacre with the intention of intimidating and terrorizing an entire population. It didn't even stop the Qassam rockets, which, you know, still flew out of Gaza. So there's no question that the Israeli army is a terrorist organization that has to be, and this has to be said, and it had to be called out. So conscientious objectors, the refuseniks, are absolutely the heroes of today. There's no question about that in my mind.
Someone's asking if you can speak about the case of Zakaria Zubaydi, co-founder of the Freedom Theater, part of the Palestinian resistance, He's on total hunger strike with no water, no food, in prison.
I don't know enough about it to really talk. I mean, I know him and I know who he is and I've met him, but I really don't know enough about what's going on, so I apologize.
Another question. Can you speak, do you know anything about the role of the Rothschild family in relationship to the creation of Israel?
Well, I know they gave a lot of money. And I know that the Balfour Declaration was written by Balfour, you know, to Rothschild, but I don't really have any details now.
How do we gain the support of the American Christian right who support Israel, the Israeli regime, without question?
Okay, well, we can't. We can't. Somebody asked me the other day, I spoke in Orange County, near, you know, between LA and San Diego, and somebody asked me, you know, why are you speaking to, you know, preaching to the choir? Why don't you go speak at AIPAC? Well, to begin with, they don't invite me. But besides the fact they don't invite me, here's the issue. After the massacre in Gaza that ended right when President Obama was being inaugurated 4 years ago, I spoke about this in San Diego, at the University of San Diego, and the Zionist community took up the first two rows. And then afterwards they came and they attacked me and they argued with me, how could I possibly criticize Israel at such a time? And my point to them was this, you know, this has nothing to do with politics. You either agree that it's wrong to drop bombs on children, or you don't. That's it. That's what defines the difference between the Christian right and the AIPAC and all the Zionist supporters in this country and people like us. It's a question of values. It's not a question of politics. If you can somehow in your mind justify dropping a bomb and killing a child, the conversation's over. There's nothing to talk about because I cannot imagine a situation where this would be justified. If we look at the Jewish, you know, if we look at Jewish tradition, you know, there's a famous story of Sodom and Gomorrah when God decided to destroy the Sodom and Gomorrah, right? And Abraham walks up to him and he says, wait a minute, what if there are 50 righteous people? You're still going to destroy it? And it's one of the most dramatic stories in the Torah, in the Old Testament. And God says, well, no, okay, if there's 50, I won. Then he walks up to him and he says, but what if there's 40? Are you still going to destroy it? And this human being walks up to God, who he happens to believe in, which is a whole other story, but that's fine. He walks up to God, and he argues and negotiates that you will destroy the lives of 10 innocent people along with the wicked. You'll destroy, you will kill the righteous. This is Jewish values. And it's a question of values. If anybody can imagine justifying killing a child, dropping a bomb and killing a child, conversation's over. And they can, and they do. The problem with AIPAC is not that they don't know. The problem with people who support Zionism is not that they don't know. It's that they think it's okay. They justify it. And that's the end of the story, and that's why we can't change their mind. Because it's not a mind issue, it's a values issue.
It's a heart issue.
Yeah.
Because there's actually another question just asking, you'd say a little more about AIPAC and what they're doing, and also asking if they've ever invited you to speak there.
No, they haven't. I could go on and on all night. I think it's actually more interesting to talk about J Street than AIPAC, because I think AIPAC, everybody knows, AIPAC is the mouthpiece of whoever happens to be the most radical voice in Israel. J Street pretend to be this more liberal-leaning kind of nice Israeli kind of a thing, you know, we're a little more liberal, we don't agree with everything the government does, we believe the Palestinians do deserve a state, and so on and so forth. And I think this whole notion, this whole kind of weird creation of somehow these liberal Zionists is far more dangerous because it's the fig leaf. You know, J Street is the fig leaf that allows AIPAC to function. And so I think I don't know if they work together or not, but in reality, this is how they work together. And I think that AIPAC is, I said this in another talk, I think it's a little dog with a big bark. And I think as soon as people start
stepping up and saying no, as you should to any bully, then their bark will become smaller and smaller until they shrivel down and disappear. But I think it's extremely important. You know, when you think, you know, if you think of yourself as running for office, Israel is probably number 10,000 on your priority list, right? You've got your constituents, you've got education, healthcare, the things that people care about. But if you don't support Israel, then you're not going to get elected, because AIPAC's got connections and they have a little money and all sorts of. So you say, fine, I'll go with AIPAC. Now let me get elected. I think this is, that's why, you know, the president is giving his acceptance speech, talking about all these very important issues, and he has to say, and we support Israel. Why? Why do you support Israel? Give me one reason why you support Israel. Well, I have to do it because to get elected. That is the only reason. So I think what's going to happen is this, and I really believe this. I think the more and more Jews in America are realizing that Zionism is wrong. You know, I'm booked to speak in a lot of events between now and Thanksgiving. At least half of them are organized by Jewish activists and Jewish organizations. So I think it's wrong to assume that all of Jewish America agrees with AIPAC. I think there's a large group of, I think it's going to grow, because more and more American Jews are going to get sick of Zionism and sick of AIPAC. And they may like going to synagogue and to services, but that doesn't mean they want to write the check and for AIPAC and hear all the AIPAC nonsense every single time they go. And I think the more that happens, the easier it will be for other Americans who are not Jewish to criticize Israel. A lot of times, and I hear this a lot, it's easier for you to say, but when we say it, we're called anti-Semitic. And nobody wants to be called that, of course. I will say this, if all they can do is call you anti-Semitic, so be it. Could be worse. I think being a Zionist is worse. But the thing is, I think it's going to be kind of like a snowball effect. I think more and more Jews are going to realize that this is wrong. Then more and more Americans who are not Jewish are going to feel okay. The Presbyterian Church and others are, you know, really, really working and doing a lot of good things in this regard, feeling better about criticizing Israel and saying it's okay. It's got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. And then eventually, like I said, this it's going to snowball, and this little dog with a big bark is going to shrivel down and disappear. But it's going to take some courage. It's going to take some hard work. I'll answer this question because I get asked it a lot. I don't know if anybody's asked it today. But if you are called anti-Semitic, I would throw the ball right back and say, fine. Can you explain to me dropping 100 tons of bombs on a civilian population? Can you explain to me giving Palestinians less water? Can you explain to me throwing people out of their homes and destroying their towns and villages? Explain this.
It's not a Holocaust. Yeah.
So if you can explain, you know, now let's put the ball back in where it needs to be and let's talk about the real issues. Put the anti-Semitism aside for a minute and let's talk about what is really taking place. And these are the kinds of things. And this is the kind of awareness that it's going to take in order to get AIPAC to, like I said, disappear.
Thanks, Mika. I also encourage folks to check out the Jewish Voice for Peace table out there, which is standing up to AIPAC. And calls for full human and democratic rights for Israelis and Palestinians. Mika, regarding your sister Nurit, how was it that she was able to see so clearly beyond the mist?
Yeah, you have to ask her. You don't have to ask her. She's a remarkable person, and you should, you know, come and see her sometimes. I can't explain it. I really can't explain it. This is a question that she would have to answer. But she's a remarkable person, and she that's the kind of person she is.
Yeah, Google her on the web, Nurit Peled Elhanan. She gives fantastic feminist.
And get her book. It's a marvel. She and I give presentations together from time to time. And somebody asked her one time when she wrote her book about racism in Israeli textbooks. And really, she studied geography books, history books, civics books. And then she was asked what was her biggest surprise. And she said her biggest surprise was how well thought out and systemic it was. It's not like there was a racist picture here or a racist comment there. This was textbook racism, systemic racism that was put out as textbooks for children. In other words, there's no doubt that there was planning behind this. There was nothing accidental here. You know, and that was her biggest shock, that this was actually, and of course, when we step back and take a look at the big picture, we can see how the education system, a racist education system, which is very sophisticated and very subtle, and then this entire bureaucracy that Israel created in order to ruin the lives of Palestinians and make their life as difficult as possible. You know, not being allowed to travel from here to there after a certain time, requiring a permit to do this, and then restrictions to do that, and then pay money to get to apply for a permit to overcome that restriction and travel from here to there, all this complete nonsense that is designed only for racist reasons. And then the military, which is a terrorist organization, these three work together in order to enable this racist state to do what it does, and to present itself as this very sweet, very friendly, very liberal kind of a place. You know, but really, if you should read her book, it's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, I will. So Mikko, how do you see one state being created practically, and do enough Palestinians agree with this concept?
You know, I don't know if Palestinians agree or not. You know, the question is often asked, well, don't Jews deserve a state? Perhaps Jews deserve a state. Don't Palestinians deserve a state? Perhaps Palestinians deserve a state. That's not the issue. The issue is, when half the population is Palestinian Arab, you cannot have a Jewish state. Right? This is the reality. There are about 5.5 million Palestinians, maybe 6 or 6.5 million Israelis. That's going to shift very soon. And there has to be a state that allows for all of them to live in peace. This is the reality. You know, I mean, there are a lot of examples of nations, of states that have multinational states, multi-nation states. Look at Belgium, look at Switzerland, look at, you know, the whole host of other countries that are multinational states, and they get along fine. So maybe the Swiss French and the Swiss German don't like each other. Who cares? The point is they work it out and they live in one state and they're fine and they're all Swiss. This can happen. You know, the reality is, and this is another one of those myths, that there's this Judeo-Christian culture, and then there's all these barbarian Arabs and Muslims and so on. You know, the reality is that culturally, religiously, linguistically, ethnically, whichever way you want to look at it, Israelis and Palestinians are very similar. You know? So it would be perfectly normal and perfectly natural for them to be equal citizens in a state that they share. You know, and then another thing that comes up is, well, what if there's a Palestinian prime minister? And the answer to that is, let's take a look at the 12 prime ministers that Israel has had so far. You know, number one, it can't get much worse. Number two, at least 5 of them were accused, if not indicted, for corruption charges. So, you know, so there will be a Palestinian. Maybe he'll be better. I mean, who cares if he's a Palestinian or an Israeli? Why does it even matter? Why does it even matter? The only thing that matters is to create some kind of a structure where Israelis and Palestinians can live together in peace in that land that they share. That's it. That's it. The specifics will have to be agreed by representatives of both parties when they're able to sit as equals. Israelis and Palestinians have never sat and talked as equals. They've never negotiated as equals. It's always been all these generals and Mossad directors with a bunch of Palestinians who have no army, no secret service, no nothing. No rights. You know, they need a permit to go from A to B. So there's never been a situation where they actually sat together and said, well, what are we going to do here? And the moment they can sit and do that, that's already the name of the game. Now they'll be able to do that. But there are lots of precedents. There's lots of places where it's been done.
Mikko, someone's asking if you could talk about the role of the U.S. in supporting and maintaining Zionism in Israel and the U.S.
Okay. I think there's this expectation. A lot of people say, well, President Obama in his second term is going to do something. He's not. And the reason he's not is that why bother? There's nothing he can do. Why bother? Take a look at Egypt. How long did it take the American administration to support the revolution? It's when they knew for sure that there was no other way. Until the very last minute, the State Department and the Israeli Foreign Department were doing everything they could to support this monster, Mubarak. They did everything they could to support him. When they saw that there was nothing they could do anymore, then they started supporting the revolution. I think this is going to be the same thing. I think the transformation will take place as a result of grassroots work. I think it's going to be the weekly protests that take place in Palestine every single week. It's going to be the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It's going to be, those are the types of things. And it's going to be the lessening of American popular support here for Israel. Those are the kinds of things. Now, it's not going to happen as a result of a majority. None of these things happen because everybody agrees. There's never a consensus. You know, so apartheid didn't fall because all whites in South Africa decided to be nice one day. They were forced into this, and they'll be forced into this as well. Some will agree, some won't agree, but they're going to have to live with it. And it's a good thing because we're forcing them to do a good thing. We're forcing them into something, hopefully, that will lead to a better future.
Just since you just referred to it, do you want to speak at all to the growing BDS movement in this country, boycott, divestment, and sanctions?
Sure. I think like every movement, like every, you know, thing that's like that, it's not perfect. But I think it's the right way to go. I think it's a good principle. I think it's important to remember, when people talk about BDS, they often talk about products from the settlements or companies that do business with the settlements. There's no way in the world you can figure out exactly what comes out of the settlements and what comes out of other parts of Israel. The entire state of Israel is occupied Palestine. Every single city in Israel is a settlement. That's the name of the game. And every single part of that has to be, the boycott has to apply to all of it. The BDS has to apply to all of it. That's what I would say. And, you know, I know a lot of Israeli friends that go with those BDS little stickers and put them on Israeli products so people won't buy them. And so I fully support that.
Someone writes, what you say is amazing and pretty incendiary for mainstream U.S. Jews. Have you spoken to any of these Jews, and what's been your reception? And what are mainstream Israelis' reactions to what you say?
Well, they completely ignore me. It's not like I've been invited. But when they do show up, you're right, they're shocked. I mean, I talk to progressive Jews, and when they hear about the idea of not having an Israel, they break down into tears. And they agree with everything I say. I think there's several problems. One is that education that we receive in the West always portrays Jews as victims. And, you know, in Western Christian Europe, it's true, they were victims for a very long time. But that doesn't make us all victims, you know, and that we somehow need this strong state of Israel to protect us so we have a place to go. You know, Israel hasn't proven itself to be such a good protector of Jews. I think Zionism has managed to destroy so much of Jewish culture, both Arab Jewish culture and European Jewish culture. So I don't know that Zionism is such a savior. But it is very scary for a lot of Jewish people to think that there won't be an Israel. And a lot of Americans have bought into that, you know, that Jews need somehow Israel, and if we love our fellow Jews, we need to support Israel. And the other problem is that so many Jews have allowed Zionism to take a hold, you know, a hold of them and their lives. And they've identified with Israel. Like I said, Zionism is as far away as you can possibly get from Judaism in terms of values. Zionist values say it's okay to drop bombs on children. Jewish values say it isn't. It's as clear as that. And by allowing themselves to be taken in by Zionism, many Jewish communities, I think, have lost their Judaism. They lost their Jewishness when they became Zionists. But I can't take away from the fact that it's very frightening for them because this is how they were taught and this is what they were told. And they're going to have to somehow work this out.
Can I ask one last question and then want to leave time for you to sign people's books?
Okay.
Zionists have come the buildup of military power in Israel. The person writes, I'm curious, why didn't the Arab countries do the same for Palestine?
What was the first part of the question?
The Zionists helped fund the buildup of power, military power in Israel. Why didn't the Arab countries do the same for Palestine? Help build up militias,
armies? You mean Zionists overseas? It's not the same thing, you know. Just because Arabs are Arabs, it doesn't mean that they have somehow the same agenda. I think this is a mistake that often people make. Some Jews who bought into the notion of Zionism did a very good job in supporting Israel, financially, politically, and otherwise. Okay? They're not all Jews. They're some Jews. Okay? To assume that because this happened, all of the Arabs can somehow get together and support Palestine, I don't think that's realistic. I don't think the two sides are somehow analogous or can be compared. It's not the same thing. Arabs may be Arabs, but Syrians are Syrians, Lebanese are Lebanese, Egyptians are Egyptians, Palestinians are Palestinians. There's not that, you know, it's not the same thing as, you know, this very particular group of Jewish people who believe in this very particular ideology supporting it, you know. So I don't think there's a place here to compare the two. And that's why you're not going to see the two. Having said that, you know, Arab countries and many Arabs, both countries and individuals, help Palestinians a lot financially and otherwise. You know, they contribute and they've given money to, and so on and so forth. So that's not to say it doesn't happen at all, but that very, very focused ideology, that very, very focused effort to support this very particular ideology is something that makes sense to those people. It doesn't mean that on the other side there's an equivalent.
That's a big thank you.
Thank you.